Riverhead Books and Read It Forward present Marlon and Jake Read Dead People, a podcast with Marlon James and Jake Morrissey.
I'm very excited to talk about dead people because I love speaking ill of the dead.
It was the worst of times. It was the worst of times.
You know what? I'm not going to defend that book.
Enough about you. Let's talk about what I think.
They're Jane Austen characters. I love that everybody's like, why?
Not a fan of The Hobbits.
I'm about to walk out of this room right now.
If you're going to be that obvious, why don't you just hit me with a 2x4 and be done?
That is some serious shit.
Hello there, and welcome to another episode of Marlon and Jake Read Dead People.
Sorry, I didnn't mean to just jump in on that.
It's all right. I always like to hear from you.
I was feeling unders.
Well, here is the underappreciated Man Booker Prize winning and best-selling author Marlon James. Say hello.
Oh, right. This is the part where I talk. Hello. I was waiting for canned applause.
And I am...
Hey, podcast land.
I am your humble but lovable editor, Jake Morrissey. So, as always on this podcast, we are going to be talking about authors, dead authors, authors so dead they will never hear us praise or criticize them, which is probably good, as we have a lot of opinions. We talk about authors we like and authors we don't. Books they wrote that we like and books they wrote that we think are a waste of paper and pixels. So I guarantee that what we say here today will surprise you because what we say will surprise us too. This conversation is unrehearsed, unforeseen, and unexpected for both of us.
Well, for a second, I thought you were going to say unprepared. I'm like, I did the homework.
There will be a final at the end. So stick around for the fun as Marlon and Jake talk about dead people. So let's dive into right now what we're calling a book I love, a book I hate. Each of us has chosen books by dead authors that we love, that we would take with us to a desert island and reread until it fell apart in our cold, dead hands. And we've also chosen books that we can't stand, that we toss aside without a second thought. So let's see what we come up with. What do you got?
You know, we've stayed away from the recently deceased because that would be weird and possibly disrespectful.
And actionable in some situations. You know?
Book I love, Wide Sargasso Sea by Gene Rees. You know, this book has been not just a book I love, but a book that has been a huge influence on me. Such an influence that in my second novel, The Book of Night Woman, I actually had an estate called Calibri in tribute to her, Calibra. And a lot of reasons I love it are very personal. To be in the Caribbean but disconnected. She's writing about being a white woman in the Caribbean and not fitting in anywhere.
We'll talk a little bit about what the genesis of the novel
is. Yeah, I mean, before even all of that, I mean, Wide Sargasso Sea, of course, was Jean Rees's response to Jane Eyre. And she's talked about it, how... When she came across the first Mrs. Rochester, it was one of the few times that she recognized herself in her work, and it was the mad woman in the attic. And what led to that? What could have undone a white woman in the Caribbean that by the time she comes to London, to the UK, she's deranged and burning down houses? And it just struck her, and I think it's to be so dismissed and denied. I'm pretty sure Jean Rees heard about Edward, what's his name again? Some jackass named Edward, who wrote this history of, Edward Long, who wrote the history of Jamaica, and he just went off on the Creole woman, how she's some sort of wanton beast. And you can tell that some Bronte came across this book. And,
oh, right.
Yeah. And because it's set in, you know, it's in Jamaica and so on, and she just gave agency to this character, and she went through, she really broke it down how a person like Bertha, who is not Bertha, her name is Antoinette, could have been driven crazy. And I remember because I went back and read Jane Eyre earlier this year, and one thing I thought of is I want to write a sequel where Rochester drives her mad as well.
Oh, interesting. All right, I love this book too, but what I want to know from you is if you're an author, mm-hmm. and somebody if you're Charlotte Bronte, mm-hmm. and somebody takes one of your characters and has a different reality for it, does that piss you off? Does that make you happy?
No, I think it'd be great because I think you have to allow for a character resonating with you that even the author didn't intend. Like, okay, they're Jane Austen characters I love that everybody's like, why? I was like, and if, yeah, I think if I was going to pick a character who I would write about, if I was going to pick a character from Pride and Prejudice to write a sequel for, it would have probably been Elizabeth's best friend, whose name I forgot.
Oh, Charlotte.
Charlotte.
Yes.
See, I'm very interested in Charlotte's choices.
See, there's some speculation among some scholars that Charlotte was the one who tips off Lady Catherine de Bourgh that it's going to be, that Elizabeth Bennet is going to marry Mr. Darcy. And that's how she comes to, you know, when she says, "An report of an alarming nature has reached me." In other words, Charlotte is the Iago of Pride and Prejudice.
No, Charlotte's just keeping it real.
Well, Charlotte's also like, a plain woman in Regency England who isn't looking for love. She's looking for
homegirl recognizes her choices and is like, you know what? I'm going to take this loser.
Yes.
Well, he's kind of a halfway loser. Oh, I love how we've totally gone far from White Surrogacy.
Sorry. back. Yeah.
But back to, yeah, it's, I mean, aside from just the sheer brilliance of the novel and how she managed to pull it off in around one-third the length of Jane Eyre, it's one of the, to me, it's an example of how you can bring agency to a character that somebody, another author has taken agency away from, which is interesting. It's interesting going, I don't like how you did that character, so I'm going to write a book where I deal with it. That's interesting.
Did you, I mean, I don't want to get too far away from this either, but did you ever, when you mentioned Pride and Prejudice, did you ever read P.D. James wrote a mystery called Pemberley, which was essentially there's a murder at Pemberley with Elizabeth Bennet and Mr. Darcy and Mr. Bingley.
Who dies? Bingley, please.
No, it's the one that Lydia marries, the bad guy, that Mr. Wickham.
Oh, well, Wickham should die, though.
He should. Well, no, he doesn't die. I think he's one of the suspects. My point is, P.D. James actually chose to make the main character of the novel Mr. Darcy, not Elizabeth.
Really?
I mean, she runs around in this thing, but I keep thinking, I don't want to hear about what Mr. Darcy is feeling about
this. The problem
is,
every time we think Darcy, no, we think Colin Firth. So we go, yeah, we'll allow it because he's pretty.
Well, I don't want to go there, but I mean, but the idea that this is a book about a woman who makes a choice, and the P.D. James, whose main character has always been Adam Dalgliesh, you know, a man. My point in all this is that because different authors make different choices in how they tell the story, it affects how the reader views the same set of characters. At least it did for me. Mm-hmm. Okay, enough about you. Let's talk about what I think.
Let's talk about you.
The book I chose was We Have Always Lived in the Castle by Shirley Jackson, which was published in 1962, actually by Viking. And it is considered by some people to be kind of the culmination of Shirley Jackson's literature or writing. And it's the story of two sisters and their uncle who live in this house at the edge, at the margins of a small town in New England. And various things happened before the book starts, which is several members of the two sisters' family have been poisoned by arsenic that was found in the sugar bowl. And these people have lived on the margins of this small town and have been kind of shunned by the people who live there. And the thing about that that fascinates me is that it's a very intimate story of evil and a very intimate story of ultimately horror, because as the pages turn, and it's not a very long novel, as the pages turn, you start to realize, okay, these people aren't quite as I thought they were to begin with. And you think, And when the shit goes down, and it goes down.
Ooh, we can say shit.
Oh, we can say shit.
Okay.
When the shit goes down, you think, oh, God, I didn't see this coming. And yet, it can't be anything but this.
I thought that, too. The sort of surprising but inevitable.
Yeah, exactly.
I was like, how is something, an ending that makes perfect sense? I know something was coming. I'm like, but not that.
Exactly.
I love that novel. I remember, who's this that again? My name is Mary Kate, and they call me Mary Cat. I dislike washing. I like Richard Plantagenet, and my family's dead.
It's the feel-good novel of 1962.
Oh, right. I love it. I teach that book almost every year when I teach fiction. I teach that novel.
How do the students react?
They're freaked out of their flipping minds.
Really? Because?
I think because they have decided that because it's set in a certain time period, it's going to be this kind of novel.
Yeah.
Or it's either going to be A Catcher in the Rye or it's going to be Middlemarch.
And it's neither.
And it's neither. And also, you know, I teach some coddled kids. So, you know, when a novel goes pitch black.
Yeah. And in, you know, pitch black in like fewer than 200 pages.
Yeah.
It's not long. And it sucks you in so fast and so almost effortlessly.
She, for me, is one of the all-time great. Mary Cat is one of the all-time great unreliable unreliable characters. Mm-hmm. Especially because she made it very clear I should not be trusted.
Yes.
But you trust her anyway.
You totally do.
And then she totally pulls the rug out from you.
Yes.
I'm trying to think of another novel that did that. Because, I mean, usually an unreliable narrator kind of just announces themselves. Like the narrator in The Good Soldier.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean,
the idea, too, that you are, I guess my, to your point, there's the unreliable narrator, and then there's the unreliable narrator whose side I'm on anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a little bit like what, at least I, when I read Mary, We've Always in the Castle, like, oh yeah, you're not actually telling us the whole truth here. Mm-hmm. And yet I'm kind of on Team Mary Cat.
Yeah, because the as bad, well, before any of the characters come off bad, the tone is terrible.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, they're short-sighted, they're bigoted, they, you know, all their worst prejudices about young women living alone or so on. And, yes. And just this sort of, you are strange and we're going to treat you terribly. So you do end up on her side, even when you realize, you know, Mary Cat got some issues. But
true enough. Mm-hmm. But the thing, too, is, for me, she is, her sister is, it's not that she doesn't, you find out over the course of the novel that the sister is aware of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like it's some, and the ability to kind of live next to evil, the ability to sort of sit in a space where there's a lot of bad stuff that's going on in this family, in this town. There's a lot of stuff that bad that came before, and there's going to be some bad stuff that's coming down the road.
Yeah.
And yet people are like, so what shall we have for dinner?
Yeah, that's an interesting character to write, a character that just endures shit.
Is that hard to write, do you think?
I think it's hard. For me, I know it's because I'm screaming at that character. I'm like, why don't you do something?
Do you, when you write those kind of characters, or just can you write people? Can you write characters who are not? It's not that you don't like them, but it's like that you.
They're not behaving in a way I want.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, I just end up screaming with them when I'm writing it.
And you're able to scream through the.
I'm able to scream through it because I'm just constantly outraged by what they do next.
My outrage is profound at my characters.
I know. I mean, you know, when I wrote Book of Night Woman, I was yelling every day.
Wow.
I was like, you have such shitty choices, woman.
Well, all right. Now, and do you ever think to yourself, I need to give these people better choices?
Yeah, but what would be the fun in that?
Well, that's what I mean, is that you separate your desire to be, okay, I'm going to be novelist than I am a human being.
No, it's like, Betty woke up and made all the right decisions, the end.
No, I understand that it's not the way you want to have
it's
a
like,
novel to
Richard
be
chose wisely, the end. One of the very first lessons I give my students in class is, remember this, humans are the only animals that know better but won't do better.
So know better and choose not to do better?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sometimes it.
Well, is that
realize.
True of characters as well?
Well, a lot of really good ones, yeah. I think of people like Pip in Great Expectations. He full well knows better.
Yes. Yes. Well, and
his choices are shit.
Well, yeah, but there are also characters who are, you know, who do the, you know, who do the good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, we were talking a while ago about A Man for All Seasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Thomas More burned at the stake because
he was a jackass.
He was. I don't disagree with you. He was a total buzzkill. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, okay, I'm gonna go to the stake for my immortal soul.
Thomas More is the type of person who tells you how the movie went.
Ooh.
Even though you already bought your ticket.
Ooh, he sounds.
That's Thomas More. He tells you how the movie went, and then make you know how much he didn't like it.
Yeah, I don't want to sit next to him in the movie theater, or frankly,
I'm sorry. Even the fires at the stake went. God, him. Let's just get it through.
And yet, he's a saint in the Catholic Church.
Yeah, but that was just to spite Henry VIII, who should be. Spitten, but that's not a word.
Who should be spited? Spited, exactly. All right. We've talked about two books we like. What book do you hate?
Man, even last year I tried again with this book. Is that the third time I'm trying? And I still can't stand it. Wuthering Heights.
Okay. I wish I could say I disagreed with you, but I am so on Team Marlon on this one because it is, without a doubt, the biggest waste of my emotional space.
I think I've that's ever the thing about it. Book. Like a book like Jude the Obscure really taxes your emotions, mm-hmm. but it's worth it. I mean, we could just say that about any Thomas Hardy book, right. Except Return of the Native, which is shit. But but it that kind of taxing sort of rewards it. With Wuthering Heights, every time I start reading Wuthering Heights, I actually find it refreshing that the characters are unlikable.
At the outset.
At the outset.
Okay.
And then you realize, hold on, I'm going to spend quality time with these people.
Exactly.
And to me, there are parts that's overwritten. There are parts where I'm like, man, these Brontes really don't get human emotion,
exactly.
Do they?
Exactly.
And that's fine. I'm on whatever planet they're living on when they read with their books, and it's their frame of reference. This goes for all the Brontes except probably Anne, but their frame of references aren't human emotion. They're what they've read.
Well,
about human emotion.
Okay, I would that makes sense to me. The one thing I would say about the characters in Wuthering Heights for me is that they are every single one of them unbelievably selfish.
Yeah.
It's all about me, 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 me. And frankly, you know, I don't care for Heathcliff, who loves Kathy, who's married to somebody. I mean, I just keep thinking, you know, to your point, I don't get the rationale. I don't get the human emotion that you're trying to actually corral by the overwhelming passion you have. I'm not there. Mm. Let's turn the page. Let's close the book. Let's leave them on the Yorkshire moors and hope to God they get professional help someday.
And a lot of the narrators, it's. I remember the first time I read this book, I'm like, damn, this is one kinky ass book. And
why isn't that listed on the cover?
That should
be
the blurb.
A kinky ass book, Marlon James.
This is one kinky ass book.
One kinky ass book.
But it's not. But it doesn't reward that kink. And a lot of it is just so. There's so much of it that is just so sort of. For want of a better word, not it's a perfect word, so unabashedly cruel,
yes.
For no reason.
Right.
Even something as simple as whoever is that guy who narrates it, one of the most pompous jackasses ever to narrate a novel. The first narrator, what's his name again?
It's not Earnshaw, is it?
Is it Earnshaw? No, it's not an Earnshaw. He's not related.
Okay.
The first narrator of the first section, the really pompous guy. And I think it's where the ghost or the spirit sticks her hand through the window and he just rakes her hands across the broken glass. I was like, wow.
He's fun. One fun guy.
I was like, damn, Emily, that is some nasty-ass shit.
Well, have you ever been to the Bronte Parsonage in Haworth?
Mm-mm.
It's exactly what you
would
expect.
Sounds like a barrel of laughs.
Yes. I mean, you look out the windows of this thing into the churchyard of all these, you know, 200-year-old gravestones, and you realize, oh yeah, they drew water from the well that had leaching dead bodies.
Pretty much, and they wonder why they had plague every
exactly.
year.
Exactly. So you're thinking, you know, I get why they're batshit crazy.
British people are pretty dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny though. And as much as I dislike Wuthering Heights, it still had a kind of impact on me. Although I've never finished it. Yeah, it's. I remember watching the last Pride and Prejudice, and Darcy's coming over to Moore's.
Oh, the Keira Knightley one?
Yeah.
Yes.
And because I'm a nerd, I'm screaming at the screen, that's not Darcy, that's Heathcliff.
Well, you're exactly right. You're exactly right.
I kept going, why is Heathcliff in this movie?
You have bewitched me. Yeah, that's not
Yeah,
that's
but
not
on a
Mr.
Heathcliff,
Darcy.
That sounds like vampires about to show up.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's an unpleasant novel, and a lot of people, I mean, there are people, that's their holy grail novel.
Well, I mean, the thing about it, if you look at Jane Eyre has a beginning, a middle, end. People mm-hmm. change, things happen.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about Wuthering Heights is everybody's, from page one, everybody's mm-hmm. doomed.
Yeah.
There's no upside here.
Which initially sounds kind of badass, especially for somebody like me who listens to a lot of goth records.
Mm-hmm.
So the kind of, we're all gonna die.
Well, okay, I don't have any problem with that, except it's unrelenting.
Yeah, and then I'm like, die already.
Exactly.
And then when you die, you come back as a ghost, and still you're an unpleasant ghost. Yes. It's unpleasant.
Now, when you mentioned that, it made me think of the year, and I can't remember which was, it might have been 1946 or 47, the year that Harvey won the Pulitzer Prize for drama. Was the same year that The Glass Menagerie was on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
And weirdly, that didn't win. I mean, a classic of a...
Shocker.
Well, the thing is, my rationale for that was, all right, in this period of time, Harvey is a book, is a story about people connecting with a 6 foot three tall invisible rabbit and all the people in this small town, Elwood P. Dobbs, Dobbin. Anyway, and... The Glass Menagerie is a play about we're all alone, spinning, solitary in a godless universe. It's like there's no there's no hope in the Glass Menagerie because we all end up unhappy. And that's my kind of feeling about Wuthering Heights. It's like this is just unrelentingly horrible for all eternity.
Yeah, pretty much.
And on that happy note, I'm going to move on to
God,
my...
God, it's yours. I hope it's funnier than mine.
Well... Yes, it's less grim. It's Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
You just don't like childhood.
I just don't like my problem with this, with Alice in Wonderland, it doesn't go anywhere. Nothing happens. Alice, you know, she's sitting by the side of the river and the rabbit runs by and she follows him and goes down this tree and she, you know, eats these psychedelic foods and gets bigger and smaller and then she goes...
You've said like 10 verbs already.
Well, my point,
there are things happening.
Well, my point is that it doesn't lead to anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit like set up.
So no. This award show went to where they serve dessert. I was like, where's the rest of the meal? Seriously, what are we doing?
If you have to ask, it's not coming.
Yeah.
It's not going to be there. But the thing for me about Alice in Wonderland that I found so annoying is it's not even all that engagingly written. It's
mm-hmm.
not particularly funny. The thing about Lewis Carroll for me was he was a mathematician. He was somebody who was kind of a scholar and an academic who had interesting things beyond telling stories to these small girls that Alice in Wonderland became the genesis for. And there's a lot more interesting stuff in his life,
mm-hmm.
a lot more creepy stuff too.
He's kind of into creepy dude territory.
Yes, but my point is he could have been a lot more interesting. It could have mm-hmm. been a 19th century, I don't know, Wrinkle in Time, or a 19th century, even a romp that might be fun that would lead to, oh, Annie M., there's no place like home kind of insight.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just unrelenting crap.
I realized for a long time I would defend Wizard of that Freudian slip is important. I would defend Alice in Wonderland, realizing, oh yeah, when she click her heels and she's back though, and
yeah.
I go, oh wait, that's Wizard of Oz.
Exactly.
Alice in Wonderland is one with the Mad Tea Party.
Yes, and even if you see something like the Disney cartoon version of Alice in Wonderland, as you're watching, you realize, oh wait a minute, there's disappearing cats and talking caterpillars. It doesn't add up to anything. It's almost like listening to your parents' drunken friend talking about a story about, you know, a fish that got away when he was fishing one, and it kind of trails off and he never quite finishes and you never quite figure what the point is. So
your drunken relatives aren't like mine. My drunken relatives ask, why did my husband leave me? I'm four.
See, this is, see, that's the difference between growing up in Jamaica and growing up in New England. Everybody's living in, you know, all of my relatives were like characters from The Graduate, except with no tans. You know, they were like basically, we don't talk about these problems.
Well, I thought you meant they were having inappropriate sex.
No, alas, they were not having sex at all, probably. But you know what? I'm sure that's not what my family wants to hear.
You know, your family will be watching me, listening to this podcast.
Yes, that's what I'm afraid of. I love you all. Okay. Coming up next is a part of the show we call Dead People, Dead Places, and Dead Things. These are aspects or details of the books or authors that we just talked about that struck us as interesting or unusual that we might have specialized knowledge about. So what do you think about White Sargasso Sea and Jean Rhys?
Yeah, the interesting thing about that novel is that Jean Rhys is Dominican and she's writing about Jamaica. So she writes about a Jamaica that has this weird French flavor.
That's interesting. Like, I didn't know she was from Dominica.
Yeah. No, she's definitely not from Jamaica.
And you could tell that from her?
I could tell. I don't think a Jamaican essay would have been called Calibra.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we'd be like Montpellier, you know, or Shaw Park Gardens, you know, or some shit like that. These places are still around.
Wow.
Yeah, they're hotels now.
For tourists?
For tourists. Yeah. Somebody asked me, would you want to stay at Plantation Inn? I'm like, yeah, once I come from my suntan at Auschwitz. Like, why would you have that as a hotel? Anyway, but to come back on point, it's interesting, though, reading her view of a certain part of the country. Like, I grew up pretty much in Spanish Town.
Okay.
That she writes about. And the Spanish Town, and a lot of what she talks about, a lot of that 19th century Spanish Town is still there. So I find myself confronting my own country's history.
Is it still there in terms of, like, people are living in it?
People
or is
are
it
still
like
living
history?
There, okay. And it's but a lot of the old buildings are still there. Mm. The old King's House from the 19th, or is it the 18th century, is still there. The memorial for Rodney defeating the French
is still
there, Admiral Rodney Memorial. So it's still very much one of those cities that the British actually spent some time to build, because they usually don't give a shit.
Right.
And whenever I'm in London, I said, yeah, this reminds me of Spanish Town, which they find cute because they don't think the colonies are anything. But it's the same kind of thin, narrow streets, winding roads, old buildings holding old secrets. And so whenever I'm reading it, it's something when you're reading about a place you actually live. Mm-hmm. And I've been to and know very well, and seeing somebody else's sort of way in which they read it, then make you turn around and look at the place differently.
Yeah.
Which I wouldn't have thought of, because to me it's like, look at this old-ass building. You know, but now I'm thinking, man, 200 years ago or 300 years ago, what was happening here?
So basically she's doing the same thing with Jamaica or with Kingston that she did with the novel. In other words, making you look at what you thought you knew in a different way.
Yeah, and I think especially growing up in a country like Jamaica, and I'm sure it goes for any one of these British colonies, there's a sort of secret history that you think you know, but then you don't.
Right.
And when I was, which I said before that this book was very instrumental in how I wrote Book of Night Woman. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that came from just, you know, trying to uncover that sort of secret untold history of Jamaica that's not in the history books. And also just the ways in which living in that time and place can make you make choices that normal people don't make.
Yeah.
So it sends me into sort of nostalgia for an era I don't have nostalgia for. I mean, I have no desire to live in 19th century Jamaica.
Interesting. I'm glad you mentioned all this, because what I wanted to talk about with We Have Always Lived in the Castle is I, too, grew up in the town town next to where Shirley Jackson lived in the 40s and 50s and 60s. When
Did you
she...
kill people every summer?
Exactly. We each have our nicely round stones that we save from year to year. Mm-hmm. And she was born in California and married the critic Stanley Hyman, who was Jewish, and he taught at Bennington College, which was up the hill from North Bennington, Vermont, where they lived. And the stories you heard growing up about Shirley Jackson and her family were that she was not a particularly attractive woman. She was overweight. She had four children. She would walk down the hill from the rented house that they lived in, and to go to the one store in town. And the story is, I think it's apocryphal, but the story that I heard was, you know, little boys in town would throw stones at this kind of odd looking woman.
Mm.
Obviously, the connections to the lottery being part of that, mm-hmm. but the idea of being kind of separate and other and marginalized,
yeah.
and on the margins that are part of, we have always lived in the castle, I think is a lot about how Shirley Jackson perceived both her life in North Bennington and also her sense of the life, people, they were intellectuals basically in mm-hmm. in a basically small farm town in the middle of nowhere in Vermont. And the sense of you not being from seven generations of Vermonters, and therefore you were less than.
Mm-hmm.
You were not somebody who would be embraced or appreciated by the townspeople, which is, you know, fast forward 40 years, 50 years, she's, you know, they have a every year on the day in June, I think it is, when the lottery takes place,
mm-hmm.
they now collect on the green and read aloud the short story of the lottery.
Oh, I thought you were going to say collect on the green and kill somebody.
You're always waiting for the death.
I'm just saying.
You're,
I don't
just
know
waiting
how,
for the death.
I've heard about American small towns.
Yes.
I don't know.
Well, that's the thing. Growing up as a kid, I mean, I didn't know obviously Shirley Jackson or her family, but I felt the isolation. I felt mm-hmm. the kind of loneliness in terms of, like, you know, this could be a place if you weren't, as I was, but if you weren't somebody's son or grandson or nephew or cousin, if you weren't mm-hmm. connected to the fabric of the community, it could be a very difficult place to break into. I had a friend in high school whose family actually bought Shirley Jackson's house from her husband. Mm-hmm. Shirley died first, and then Stanley died later. And people there were over the course of the time that I knew the family that lived there, people would just come up and knock on the door and say, mm-hmm. "Is this where Shirley Jackson lived?" And and my friend and his family would give them tours,
yeah.
of the house, and they would. Shirley Jackson had a lot of, like, cat statues or, you know, figurines and things like that, and that they just sort of left in the house when they mm-hmm. moved out. And there was a period of time when if you were a tourist and were interested in Shirley Jackson, they would, the people owning the house would give you a cat on the way out as, like, a parting gift or whatever.
That's a lot of cats.
It's a lot of cats. And so the idea that you can be part of a community and kind of share in the sort of collected celebrity of somebody who was gone
mm-hmm.
from a place that she was excluded from,
mm-hmm.
I found both really interesting and poignant, because
yeah.
I have felt that.
It's sort of like how a lot of Jamaica's upper crust now embrace Bob Marley.
Right, because he's a great draw now.
He's a superstar. He's yeah. dead. He's, you know,
nobody can admit
that. Yes, so they can all know. I guess they didn't give him a hard time the whole time he was alive,
right.
and they excluded him, and Rastafarians are persecuted the whole time. And now it's like, yeah, you know, I love Bob Marley and blah blah blah. I'm like, yeah, whatever.
Now does he still have family there in Jamaica?
Most of them live abroad.
Right.
But this kind of sort of paying tribute but also making money from somebody you ostracize when they're alive.
Right.
It's like, you know, you don't get a pass for that.
No. And you don't get to overlook or forgive behavior
mm-hmm.
just because the world changed and you were basically, we don't get to forget that you were a bully or an asshole to these mm-hmm. people simply because Shirley Jackson is now famous, and people come to your town and look around for stuff about Shirley Jackson, or come to Jamaica to find out about Bob Marley, and you can pretend somehow to have some vague connection to him or his music or his family. Or
I hope that I've read at least one of her books.
Well, I would hope so. I mean, she was somebody who was also, she didn't have it's not like she wrote, her books were short. Mm-hmm. And she wrote two different kinds of books. She kind of was these books of kind of domestic sort of evil and horror. And then she wrote these collections of kind of early Irma Bombeck, you know, funny things about raising children. She wrote a book called Raising Demons.
I'm pretty sure this is the only podcast that has name check Irma Bombeck. I'm pretty sure.
You know what? This is what we're here for. We're a one-stop literary podcast. Finally, we come to the warmest, fuzziest part of the show, a segment we call I Don't Give Two Shakes of a Rat's Ass What You Think. This is where each of us makes a case for a book or author that we know the other probably won't agree with, but one we're willing to stand by. So what case do you want to make, Marlon?
Wow, what case do I want to make? Let's see. This guy is a remnant of the colonial era, racist, sexist. Books haven't aged well, and I've read nearly all of them, and I flipping love them.
And they are?
James Clavell.
All right.
Give me Shogun any day.
Noble House.
Shogun, King Noble Rat. House. I read Taipan first. Talk about racist.
Totally.
Oh, my God.
Now, when did you read them? Were you young?
I read all of them when I was 13.
Did you get them? I mean, did you understand?
Well, a friend of mine had one, and I was like, he had Taipan, and I think he read it and didn't understand it. And I'm like, I want to read a book that's called Taipan, because I have no idea what that is. Also, it was big, and reading a big book made me feel like I was an adult.
And smart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, you can, yeah, because I'm thinking at 13, everybody was still reading Hardy Boys.
Yeah.
Which is great. It means boys are reading, which is in itself shocking. But so everybody's reading the Hardy Boys. Or sometimes people are still reading Bobbsey Twins like they're 3 years old. I'm like, what are you reading? I'm reading Taipan, bitches. Right. All 700 pages of it. And I was really entertained. Those books have not aged well.
Now, explain. They're all written by a British.
Is he British?
I thought he was British.
I guess he was British. Isn't I also James assume Clavell? He was Irish or Scottish or something.
Well, at least from the Northern Kingdom, the United Kingdom somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere in that place.
And he writes about Asia.
But he writes about it from a very specific colonial point of view. His main characters are routinely white, unless it's somebody having sex with somebody who's white.
Right.
And but I remember being 13 years old, not having traveled anywhere, not seeing anything, barely even getting time or access to watching a movie, that this thing was, you know, it's one of the reasons why I still love big books, because I get to live a different life for a really long time. So I'd read really big books really slow, because I know once I'm done, I'm back at, you know,
real life.
I'm back at 12 Home Avenue. My address was actually called Home Avenue. 12 Home Avenue in St. Catherine, Jamaica, where nothing was happening. Well, it was only getting more boring.
The first Clavell book I read was Noble House.
Yeah.
And it was one of those experiences for me where I thought, okay, I'm going to need a map.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to need almost like a genealogy of the. No, I lie to you. I did not read Noble House first. I read Shogun.
Yeah.
So it's like, all right, I'm going to need a map. I'm going to need
sense of... That's like the original white devil novel.
Well, that's the thing. And it takes place in Japan. And it's, you know, I can still quote, you know, some of the bad Japanese that I learned from. And I won't do that here. So don't ask.
Because that would be very problematic.
Yeah, precisely. But to your point, it was made into a miniseries. I remember that as a kid. It was with...
Richard Chamberlain. Yes. He was super hot.
Yes. Super hot Richard Chamberlain.
And even my mom approved. Okay. My mom saw it and went, is that Dr. Kildare?
That's right. It's Dr. Kildare.
Like, wow, you've never aged yourself more than you have right now, Mom.
Well, I remember going, you know, to somebody's house. It was like a big deal. It was a event. It was a mm-hmm. television event, and really, really liking just the whole scope of it. To your mm-hmm. point about these being long novels that you can get into, the television show actually imitated that in a way that I obviously, as a little kid, hadn't seen before. But I remember really thinking that the book was. I have this experience too as an adult where you feel as if you're learning something.
Mm-hmm.
It may be total bullshit. It may be complete white imperialism. It may be a lie.
Oh, it's no me.
No?
Oh, it's totally all that.
Interesting. Well, good. I feel better now because I'm thinking I might need to maybe be slightly disbelieving here.
Yeah.
But it was, I remember reading every page.
Yeah. I you know what? I still am nostalgic for like the really big, bad 70s novel.
Well, that's a subject for another podcast, I think, because I have opinions on that as well. The book or novelist I want to make a case for, which I know you have views on, is, speaking of racist and sexist and homophobic and jingoistic, is Agatha Christie. I know you're not a fan. For my money, she is probably the best writer of detective fiction in the golden age of mystery writing, which was between World War I and World War II. And the reason has nothing to do with her prose. The reason has nothing to do with her characters. It has everything to do with how she structures a plot. The main character in her novels, in my opinion, are not the detectives, are not Hercule Poirot or Miss Marple. It's the story. It's what happens.
Yeah, but I don't know if I'm going to give her all that props because she can structure a plot. Snow White has a good plot.
That's a little bit like saying, the Snow White is a story about little people. I mean, the thing about you could sort of see the end of Snow White coming from the very beginning. The prince gets her. The thing about Agatha Christie is you don't know what's going to happen. At least I never did during the 50 or 60 odd books.
So you didn't figure out who did the murder in Orient Express?
I didn't, no.
Mm.
Or, for that matter, Crooked House, which is my favorite Agatha Christie mm-hmm. novel. Or I loved how she structured And Then There Were None, which, yeah. P.S., was not published originally mm-hmm. as And Then There Were None, as a title. It had a slightly more problematic title, mm-hmm. 10 Little N-Word.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Even worse than Little Black Sambo.
Even worse than Little Black Sambo.
Man, I got the Christie scoring points with me.
It was a different point of view she had for those, but it was also theoretically a nursery mm-hmm. rhyme.
I don't know if I'd call her the best. I mean, Wilkie Collins did The Moonstone and the Woman in White.
But I could have saved him 200 pages in one and 150 pages in another. He did not know how to end a sentence. I love
Sometimes
Wilkie Collins.
Sentence can go on, dude.
I am happy from not for sentences to go on if they're saying something. And you and I have had this conversation about long sentences. But in the case of Wilkie Collins, I really like him, but he lost interest. He only wrote four, I think.
I don't know if I'm trying to remember Agatha Christie's era. That was what, like early 20s?
Early, yes. And her book started publishing in the early 20s, and the last one was like in early 70s.
Yeah, but I mean, because when I think of early and mid 20th century great writers of crime fiction, I think of Dorothy Sayers.
Well, have you read her recently? I like Dorothy Sayers as well. The thing mm-hmm. about her is she's more about the characters. The plots themselves are not that compelling.
Mm-hmm.
I like Peter Wimsey. I like Harriet Vane. All that stuff is fine. But for me, it's almost like Joan Acocella had an interesting piece in The New Yorker about Agatha Christie a while ago. She was talking about the idea that Agatha Christie's novels are puzzles and they're also comedies.
Mm-hmm.
And they're comedies if you get that sense of kind of middle class and upper middle class English life. If, you know, the vicar and the squire and the maid and all that stuff. It's a little bit like watching something from, you know, from the stage where there's a puzzle and you got to figure out. Dorothy Sayers, I think, is a little bit more nuanced than that. And, of course, the whole American stuff about what detective fiction is, you know, the the Ross McDonalds and the Raymond Chandlers and all this stuff were doing something very different. I'm not saying her prose is deathless. I'm not saying she's worth, putting up next to Edgar Allan Poe, say. Mm-hmm. But I do think for what she did it brilliantly. Okay, so
I was going to say, yeah.
No, are you going to say something?
But I'm not going to read her.
And for that, I'm sure she's turning over in her grave. All right, so that's all for today. Thank you for listening, and all the way to the end, no less. We actually would be interested in hearing from you, so feel free to send us your thoughts, your feedback, your ideas at... love notes at wereaddeadpeople@prh.com. If you enjoyed this episode, we hope you'll subscribe to us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And another shameless plug, don't forget to rate this podcast, as it will help more people discover Marlon's brilliance and my nasal twang. So you can follow us at Riverhead Books on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram for updates on all things books, all of them written by living authors, of course. You can't have everything. And we'll have links in the show notes to all the books we discussed today. So until next time, go read some dead people.